Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, are you happy at work? Are you respected at work? Do you respect others at work? Well, we want to know about that to help you. We don't have to hear from you personally, but we want to help you understand why it's so important to be these ways, to be happy and to feel empowered in the workplace. And to do that, is the author of a book called The Fear-Free Organization, Vital Insights from Neuroscience to Transform Your Business Culture. We really do want you to be happy at work. And to help us, we're talking with the author, Joan Kingsley. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be on the show.
Well, I'm glad we can talk about this. It's really important in life in general to be respected.
Yes.
And you've done a lot of research on it. You're a psychotherapist. You've mm-hmm. worked with lots of people. You've worked in the working place mm-hmm. with lots of people. So you know what's important.
Yes.
And tell us, what's missing?
Well, I think what's missing is excitement and joy. Now, I'm not talking about every organization, obviously, because there are some organizations that are very good at creating wonderfully welcoming, loving, embracing, trusting cultures. But there are many, many organizations that are not doing that. And it feels like the bigger and more top-heavy and more hierarchical the organization, the less likely it is that you're going to find a culture that feels pretty good to work in.
And I think one of the things you talk about in the book is that people are promoted because of their productivity, not because of their people skills.
Yes, absolutely. And I cannot tell you how many people come to see myself and colleagues saying, hey, I just got this great promotion a couple months ago, but I find myself not doing the things I'm good at, and having to manage a team or a department or a group of people, and I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know anything about what makes people tick. And, you know, if somebody's willing to come and say that, then there's a lot we can do.
Right.
And where this book with the Fear-Free Organization is coming from is we want the people who are in charge of organizations and people leading teams and you know, managers of departments, we want them to understand when you tap into the fear centers in the brain, the fear networks, the limbic system, which is the emotional system, and you're tapping into fear, you are doing a lot of damage to that person's brain. And quite honestly, most people do not understand that. You know, they think, oh, this is a great way to motivate somebody. I'm going to scare them. Well, you know, it may motivate somebody very quickly, but what it does is instead of somebody thriving and being creative, you motivate them into survival mode. You motivate them into the fight, flight, freeze mechanisms.
Right. I mean, there's always pressure in business anyway.
Pressure is fine. You know, we need some pressure. We need some stress. We need, ask an actor, you know, if he doesn't have or she doesn't have a some sort of nervous energy going on before a performance, they're going to give a flat performance. And that's true at work as well. And I think, you know, one has to delineate between the differences between stress, good, healthy stress, stress that begins to tip over into the unhealthy aspects of not feeling good, not feeling confident, feeling ill, getting a lot of butterflies in your stomach, your digestive system gets affected. Then you're going down into anxiety, which is not a good place to go at all, because then you're adrenaline-driven, you're anxious all the time, you're worried all the time, and then, you know, you can go down into pure fear and panic, and that really is not a place you want the people who you work with and who work for you or who you work for. You do not want that to happen.
I guess it's the way that stress is or can be imposed on us in a manner that we are diminished by it versus enhanced by it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I'd like to say that not everybody who yells at work is a bully. You know, some people have a style, an aggressive kind of style, which is not necessarily indicative of an aggressive personality. And some very aggressive, very manipulative people can bully in very, very quiet, subtle ways. So, you know, to make all these generalizations is not such a great idea. I know a lawyer. I work with a lawyer in London. I go to his office, and he's yelling all the time at everybody, and everybody's laughing at him because they know it's a lot of bluff and bluster. And he's a good-hearted man, and he treats his staff well, and everybody enjoys working for him. But, it's his response to everyone. Now, if yelling and people started laughing and he started punishing them, that would not be good.
Right. So it's not about the style so much as the content.
And what lies beneath. What lies beneath
right.
that style.
That's the content, yes.
Yeah. And also, it's very important to know yourself and what kind of environment you want to work in. Some people love to be in highly driven, anxiety-ridden environments, you know. I mean, like journalists, they want a busy, bustling, noisy, buzzy press room. That's how they want to work. That feeds them, you know.
Well, let's look at the traits of an organization that might be hyper but not feeding people positively. And you list those in your book,
mm-hmm.
you know, that organizations often have bad guys who could be bullies.
Yes.
Or there's backbiting. How
yes.
would you define that?
Backbiting is a lot of gossiping, a lot of criticizing somebody, you know, asking somebody to do something, and then being highly, overly critical of the way they're delivering. And, you know, there's a way of getting the best out of somebody, which is encouraging them, allowing people to make mistakes. And there are very few organizations today that allow people to make mistakes, people get punished for mistakes. And if you think about, if you take the fear-free organization and bring it back into the family, which is another organization, if you raise a child who is afraid to make mistakes, you are raising a child who's afraid to learn, because part of learning is falling down and picking yourself up and moving on. And it's the same in organizations. People have to be allowed to make mistakes now and then. But in this politically correct world we live in, I mean, you think about the scientist in the UK who lost, you know, highly senior scientist who lost his position because he made a flippant comment at a conference which was recorded by somebody, something flippant about women in the science lab. Now, he's married to a top scientist, so it's not what he's about. He's not a misogynist. He lost his job, and there were huge petitions about it, but he did not get brought back, and that's a loss for all of us, really. You have to allow somebody to say, look, I really didn't mean that, and I'm sorry, and it's not going to happen again.
Well, life is very complicated,
yes.
And nowadays we live in a very hyper society about
yes.
so many ideas and who's right and who's wrong.
Yes.
And we're all different from each other.
Yes.
And so when you're a boss and you have five people working for you and each person speaks a different language than you speak.
Yes.
Personality
wise. Literally.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, even in personality, we can't expect the people that we work with to be just like us.
No, no.
But we have to know how to look at that.
We also need to, you know, a lot of this is about learning who you are and knowing yourself and having insight about yourself and what your perceptions are and the assumptions that you make. So I do this in therapy sessions. Somebody says to me, I'm really angry, I'm really upset. Well, I know what angry is to me. What is angry to you? What does that mean to you? Because I may be making assumptions about things. You know, I worked with a family where they all yell at each other all the time, and then they're on the phone every day. So, you know, looking at it from the outside in, you could assume that they don't like each other. It's
yeah.
just their way of communicating.
Right. I know couples who don't feel like they love each other unless they bicker.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you're absolutely right. And the thing about managing people is learning how to pick up the signals. And first of all, picking up the signals within yourself. How am I feeling today? What's going on? What are my biases? Uncovering the things that you don't like about people so you can manage those complicated emotions. Because, you know, you can have somebody incredibly talented working in your team who just rubs you up the wrong way, gets on your nerves. You know, you can explore that and discover that they remind you of your first grade teacher who hated you and just mm-hmm. the memory of that, or even a name. You know, you've been dumped by somebody named Gary, and then you have a meeting with somebody named Gary, and you just don't like them. And, you know, the brain works in very simplistic ways. You
right.
know, it makes very quick assessments about, it's programmed to be biased, the brain.
In a yeah. sense, we all need a third party to listen to us, listen to how we process and help us be more objective.
That would be lovely. Not everybody can do that, but you can read
right.
some good books. You can read The Fear-Free Organization. You can learn a lot about yourself, and you can understand. There's a wonderful model that David Rock created called SCARF. And you know, what do people want? They want status. They want certainty. They want autonomy. They want to be related, you know, in relationships. And they want fairness. And, you know, every manager should have that written on their wall. What do the people who work for you want? And autonomy is about allowing people to be who they are. Also, you want to create a culture that we call a hot culture. Honest, open, and trusting. And, you know, if you allow people to be honest and open and trustworthy, you build a lot of very good communications and relationships. But you have to be willing to hear the things you don't want to hear and that you don't like to hear, you know. I mean, that's very powerful. And what happens at work is people who feel they're not trusted, they start listening for what is my boss, what is my manager, what do they want to hear, rather than what do I really think? And then you get into a very vicious cycle that breeds dishonesty, and then you can have lots of terrible mistakes happen. I like to use the example of the Challenger space shuttle, where there was something that went wrong with the O-ring in the production and manufacturing. There were people in NASA who knew, and they didn't want to reveal that. I think a couple of people did try to go to the hierarchy, the bosses, and say, look, there's something wrong here. This is dangerous. But it would have cost a great deal of money to restart things and redesign things. And what happens, you know, 3, 4, 5 years later, you have a tragedy where people die and the whole country is watching.
A lot of companies seriously need whistleblowers. And they
you know,
have to be
the
respected.
Problem with whistleblowers is they often get punished, I have a case history in the book. There's a hospital in England called Staffordshire Trust, I think it's called, and they had a very toxic environment with nurses, and everybody was covering up everything. There was a lot of dirt. There were people. They actually killed 1,500 people, you know, by just mishandling them, mismanaging them, not doing the medications right, leaving them in dirt. I mean, really, really horrible. And actually, there was a whistleblower who finally wouldn't leave. You know, she wouldn't let up. Her mother had died. And, the BBC came in, and Panorama, they did an expose. They got somebody who got hired as a nurse, and they filmed everything. So, you know, know, there was a huge scandal. But, you know, the whistleblower had to leave town because the local government didn't want this exposed. The unions didn't want it exposed. So it's very difficult being a whistleblower. And we really should be encouraging them. It's really important.
I have a friend who was working in a hospital, and he saw so much mismanagement that was threatening lives of patients.
Yeah.
And he was trying to get the people who worked there to operate correctly, and they kicked him out.
Exactly. It is very sad because everybody is protecting themselves.
Yeah.
Because when a whistleblower gets paid attention to, people lose their jobs.
Right.
So everybody gets into this survival mode. And this is what we're talking about.
Right. I think a lot depends on the CEO of any company or the owner and what how they want the company to be run.
That's completely right.
And that they hire, for instance, a very wise HR person who manages conflict and helps create conversational intelligence.
Yes. Those are very wise leaders. You find it more in smaller entrepreneurial businesses than you do in the great big stakeholder-driven businesses. My husband runs a business. He's a fear-free leader in a fear-free organization. And I'm starting up on Twitter. Anytime I go somewhere during the day and I encounter somebody who is passionate about their work and giving, I'm creating a fear-free organization of the day on Twitter because I think it needs to be acknowledged. People who you know, you go into a shop or anywhere and you feel good when you leave. You feel like you've been listened to and attended to. And listening is another very big word. We do not know how to listen properly to other people, and that is a huge thing for managers to learn how to do.
Well, a lot of it is what words we use, and I did a show a while back on conversational intelligence, and it was about so many of our words create a survival mechanism in people.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you have people in fear just from the words, and aren't open anymore.
That is so true. You know, I work in a neurological hospital. I work with people on the rehab unit who have had strokes or MS, you know, really devastating disabilities. And I work also with the physiotherapists and the nurses. And so much of it I'm teaching people is about language. So if you're working with somebody who is, you know, learning how to walk again, and you say to that person, there's nothing to be afraid of. Don't be afraid. There's nothing to be afraid of. That person, the brain is saying, liar, liar. And that person goes immediately into defensive mode, becomes more afraid, and becomes more paralyzed with fear. If you get a physio or a nurse saying, absolutely, I completely understand why you're afraid. I know how hard this is. I'm going to be here to help you, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure you don't fall. That produces a whole different response. You're telling the person you understand they're afraid.
I guess when it's a universal statement, like there's nothing to be afraid of, then you don't take it seriously.
Well, the brain just automatically goes into survival mode. And, you know, the brain is very smart. And, you know, we have these non-conscious responses that we're not even aware of. You know, it's like a little kid who knows when you're lying to them.
Right, right, because it's a universal statement, not based on, we're here now, let's do our best.
Yeah, yeah. And let's all work together.
Right.
And it's like that in organizations, too.
Right.
You know.
So there were some questions that I received from your publicist about asking you how people can deal with a bullying boss.
Well, it's very complicated bullying bosses because if you're being bullied, you can be very confident with one boss and, you know, everything is fine and you're functioning well and your boss quits. Decides to go somewhere else. They hire somebody new, and that person walks in the door, doesn't like you, wants to bring their own team in, starts bullying you. And your confidence goes down so quickly, it happens, you know, in a couple of days. Doesn't take long. And what you need to do if you're being bullied is you need to keep a record. You need to create a bullying diary. And every instance has to be written down. When you go into meetings with this person, you put the record button on your phone. You record everything. You create a record. And then when you have enough evidence, you go to the right people in HR or somebody else within the organization. But you've got to have evidence, evidence, evidence. Otherwise, people think you're making things up. You could be accused of being paranoid.
And you have to also believe that there are the right people to go to, because a lot of people
don't
know what to do.
Yes, that's a problem. And sometimes you have to go outside the organization. And sometimes you have to leave. You know, it's like being in an abusive marriage, somebody beating you up. You've got to get out. You can't stay in unhealthy environments. Unfortunately, for many people, you know, who live in small communities where, you know, the work is local and you don't have much choice, that becomes very complicated. And we need kind of in government good processes for people where they can go to somebody and say, this is going on, I need help. Because bullying can do a lot of damage to a person.
Right.
You know, when your confidence gets shaken and you forget who you are. I don't know who I am anymore.
I have so many clients, have had over the years, who have worked in organizations and even in the school system in New York, who have, for instance, teachers who have principals who do everything they can to sabotage them.
Again, it's on an individual basis. Some people who are bullies grow up in abusive families. Some people are bullies have been bullied at school themselves. So there are, you know, all different reasons. I've worked with people who are bullies. They don't want to be bullies, most people. Some people enjoy it. You know, when you get into psychotic personality disorders in the workplace,
that's terrible. Right. But then again, there's a chain, as I said earlier, that, you know, the head of the company is the leader who can speak this language of either bullying or sabotage, you know, ways that create fear in order to harm people, in order to force them to do things that they shouldn't be doing.
Well, then, you know, you really have to research when you're going to work for a new organization, and this is particularly true for young people entering into the workplace. You've got to know who you're going to work for. You have to research about the culture. What is this company? I can read their mission statement. This is what they say they stand for. What do they really stand for? And then you have to try and find people who know people who work in that organization. Or you can go to Starbucks on the corner of where the organization is and just sit there for a couple of hours, get a couple cups of coffee, and listen. Listen to the conversations going on. Look at the body language. Do people look happy, joyful? Are they stressed? Are they anxious? And if you see those signs, those toxic signs, do not go work for that company.
That's so smart. You know, it's due diligence, and
we need to learn how to be that way. Yeah, it's what organizations do who are looking to buy other organizations. They do their due diligence, and it's not just about financials. They are going
equality.
Out and quest.
Sure.
So it's very powerful.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's one way that I read language in people, and it's our personalities. Many people speak a tribal language, and then there are people who speak a collective language. And the people who speak tribally are actually working more out of fear.
Yes.
And it's always win-lose. It's always, I can only win if there are losers out there.
Yeah.
And that's true for, let's say, sports teams.
Yeah.
And many religions are that way.
Yes, yes.
And it's true in companies, too.
But
I mean, you certainly
sport.
Want to beat your competition.
Yeah.
But within a company, if people can create a win-win, then...
Well, I think the win-lose thing in competition, you have to know that your competition is not internal, it's external. You're competing with the other soap company or the other techie company. You start competing within your working environment, that becomes quite toxic. And in a fear-free organization, we don't want that to happen. And it's not necessary. It's bad business practice. You know,
right,
they're very short-term results. And long-term, you lose a lot of people. Companies spend a lot of money training people, and then 2 years on, they're burned out and gone. And that doesn't serve anybody.
So people should really become more familiar with this scarf identity.
Yes, I think managers really need to understand that. That's a David Rocks model scarf.
Right.
There's another woman named Nancy Klein who, sorry, somebody's just walked in. Sorry, I'm on an interview. Sorry.
That's all right.
Nancy Klein, who is American, lives in England, and has created a wonderful model for organizations and business leaders called Time to Think, More Time to Think, and is all based on listening, on how you listen to be, the quality of your listening, how you allow people to come to their own decisions without you interfering with their thought process.
Yeah, it's a science.
It is.
And that's right. And that's why I was so glad to get involved with this book called Conversational Intelligence, because it really helped us understand what our words do.
Language is important.
Yeah.
But language is only important if you have the right body language going on underneath.
That's true, too.
You know, if you're
there's so
saying,
much to know. And your book, The Fear-Free Organization, is so helpful to so many people.
So, I hope so.
Yeah, well, I can see it. There's so much information in here that people can learn from.
And lots of case histories, real
stories
where, you know, people's identities are protected.
Yeah, it's so good to read about it.
Yeah.
Joan Kingsley, the author of The Fear-Free Organization, is there a website?
Not yet. We're working on it.
Okay.
We were too busy writing the book. We forgot to do the website, but it'll be up and running in, probably in October.
Okay, good. So people should get this book in the meantime. And I want to thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew. It's so wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.